Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's our monthly book show, and this month our theme is technology. With us is Gabrielle Faria-Kalkenna. She's reference librarian at Sturgis Public Library. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi, Mindy.
And Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, this is your pick, Gabrielle,
yes.
So tell us a little bit why you want to do technology.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about technology lately, I think because we've been hearing so much about AI, and it feels like in this moment we're on the precipice of another major change, like with what the internet brought to society. So I think it's kind of a good opportunity because we've been through such a massive change to look at, okay, what has this technology brought us? What promises did it deliver on? And where did it fall short? And what were maybe some of the costs?
Yeah.
I'm thinking there was a lot of optimism around building community and bringing people together on social media. And we've seen how that has played out. So
right.
I think before we jump at using and buying all these AI products, we should kind of reflect on what is it we want from technology.
And there's always that that unintended consequence kind of thing happening, right? So what's your first book?
So my first book is called Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. It's by Kara Swisher. The cover, she has some aviator shades on, and you'll see flames reflected there because I guess the idea is that she's sort of telling all here. It's part memoir, part history, chronicling big tech's most powerful players. Kara Swisher is a journalist who has been covering Silicon Valley and the tech industry since the early 90s. So while she was still in college, she got her start at the Washington Post, where she became one of the few people in journalism interested in covering the nascent internet. Which is kind of funny because she recounts stories where people are like, oh, this internet thing, that's a fad. That's nowhere.
Don't go nowhere, right?
That was kind of the beat nobody wanted. But she was really interested in it. So she went on to work for the Wall Street Journal, joining with Walt Mossberg to create All Things Digital, which is a big-time tech conference series that brings together the biggest names in the tech industry. She's a former contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and has written extensively for other outlets, including those she founded and created. Mm. So she currently has two really popular podcasts where she interviews big tech names. And in this book, she talks about her career and all the quote tech titans she got to know along the way. People like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, the founders of Google. So it's a good way to kind of chart the rise of the internet and follow along for the changing media landscape. She does a really good job of laying out how things changed from a journalism perspective, but also just broadly in society. What's most fun about the book is the insider gossip.
Yeah, I was going to say, sounds interesting. Yeah.
Yes. So she gets in there and she isn't afraid to speak her mind. She talks about the leaders of these tech companies who have so much power over the shape of our society. She describes many of them as thin-skinned man-children who are surrounded by sycophants. The book invites readers to reflect on the ways that tech leaders promise their customers that their products would improve their lives, bring us all together, and create community, but how, in fact, decisions driven by profit motives have in many cases had the opposite effect. So one other thing I wanted to mention. Oh, she has a major ego herself. She talks a lot about the ego of these tech bros, as she says, but I think the reason why she was able to hang in the industry for so long is because she brings that sort of bravado too. And much of the book's message seems to be, I was right. So she foresaw the destruction of traditional media and the transition towards digitizing anything and everything. But she comes off best in the book, I think, when she acknowledges her ego and kind of pokes fun at it and owns it.
Yeah.
Readers may wonder why she welcomed Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter right up until he stopped responding to her emails. So there's a little bit of this cozy relationship that you'll see that she had. You know, she's texting with these guys, but she's simultaneously covering them. She wasn't afraid to be hard on them in the press, but that's kind of the fun of being the reader and taking a little bit of a critical lens to what she's telling. So I highly recommend it. You'll get some inside scoop. It's called Burn Book, A Tech Story by Kara Swisher.
Oh, that sounds great. All right, Ray, what have you got first?
Well, first of all, thank you, Gabrielle, for choosing this topic. It's definitely not something I've ever read about before, so I really appreciate
out of your
learning.
Comfort zone.
Yes, it is, yes. And I was intimidated, but it's that's the beauty of books, right? They teach us. We don't have to know beforehand about it. So my first book is Ways of Being, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for a Planetary Intelligence by James Bridle. And it's got a beautiful cover. James is also an artist, so it's
very colorful. Yeah.
And basically, they point out that while AI is quickly developing, we're also realizing the depth and complexity of intelligence that has existed in all living things for as long as there has been life on this planet, and that we can learn a lot from these unexpected sources of intelligence, such as trees and fungi. And they examine the computer and how it has shaped the way we think. And I found this really interesting because they mentioned that there are several ways that the computer could have been designed that are different from how it did come into being. And I'm going to read a little bit because they really describe this well, how it's shaped our ideas of truth and knowledge as being that which is calculable. And they write, only that which is calculable is knowable. And so our ability to think with machines beyond our own experience, to imagine other ways of being with and alongside them, is desperately limited. This fundamentalist faith in computability is both violent and destructive. It bullies into little boxes what it can and erases what it can't. In economics, it attributes value only to what it can count. In social sciences, it recognizes only what it can map and represent. And in psychology, it gives meaning only to our experience and denies that of unknowable, incalculable others. It brutalizes the world while blinding us to what we don't even realize we don't know.
Mm. Oh, that is interesting. Deep,
yeah.
Huh?
It's very well written. It's a fascinating book. And that was Ways of Being by James Bridle.
Oh, no. I've got a lot of reading we're going to have to do here. Okay, what's next?
Next is another big one. It's The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. Mm. This is by Jonathan Haidt. It's been in the news quite a bit. It's a new release. What drew me to this is the fact that I have my own kids, and I'm, I think parents are concerned with what technology is doing to their development, and it's hard enough for us to be able to put our phones down, so we want to be able to help our kids. So he really gets into that. After more than a decade of stability or improvement, the mental health of adolescents plunged in the early 2010s. Rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide rose sharply, more than doubling on many measures. In this book, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt asks the question, why? He lays out the facts about what he calls the epidemic of teen mental illness that hit many countries at the same time. Then he investigates the nature of childhood, including why children need play, an independent exploration to mature into competent, thriving adults. He shows how the play-based childhood began to decline in the 1980s, and he claims it was finally wiped out by the arrival of the phone-based childhood in the early 2010s. Something interesting about that is he talks about how certain types of television shows, thinking like shows that depicted children being abducted and stories like that in the media that were starting to really attract audiences in the 1980s, kind of drove parents to close down that free range childhood that people grew, generations had grown up with. And he argues that parents have called their kids into the home and restricted their freedom from roaming around, but they have given them the internet with basically no restrictions. Mm-hmm. And that's actually where a lot more danger lies than in their own neighborhoods and their own communities. So he presents several mechanisms by which this great rewiring of childhood has interfered with children's social and neurological development, covering things from sleep deprivation, attention fragmentation, addiction, loneliness, social contagion, which is kind of the phenomenon where kids see things on TikTok and then it becomes part of their life. There was a story that he mentions in the book about an influencer on TikTok who had Tourette's syndrome. And then there were all of these cases of Tourette's popping up that were not in line with the statistics of how the numbers usually play out. And so I would refer you to the book for more details mm-hmm. about what that was actually like. But he was saying that there's this concept of social contagion where kids are very social creatures, like we all are, but even more so in those vulnerable developing years. And so they're absorbing a lot from these people they follow online.
The influencers, as you say.
Yes.
I didn't know. It's only been recent that I figured out what an influencer. I was like, that's a job, an influencer?
Yes, people
like,
monetize
they
this.
They make money off of
yes.
this. It's amazing.
And that's another huge piece of it, right, is selling products and doing making content that drives engagement, mm-hmm. drives eyeballs and clicks, really just to sell you a product. And
right.
kids are not always aware of what the motives are beneath the content they're consuming. They're just, you know, scrolling and going with what's trending, right? So it's not all doom and gloom, because he issues a call to action and he lays out different things that we can do. He does describe it as a collective action problem. So it's sort of the kind of thing you want to share around, you know. You can't have the only kid that doesn't have a cell phone. Well, you can, but that's going to be a struggle. It'll be easier if you can collaborate with other parents and kind of have these steps. One, for instance, is he recommends people hold off on social media until age 16. He recommends people start with your basic flip phone that can text and call.
Yeah,
and,
smart.
You don't have to jump right to a phone that has every app available and the wide internet available.
Right.
So he lays out kind of common sense practices that people can incorporate in their own lives. And he has a website that accompanies it where there's a lot of resources and recommended reading.
That sounds fascinating.
It's really good. I recommend it. The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt.
All right. If you have a book on technology you'd like to add to our list this morning, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show. Our theme this morning is technology. With us is Gabrielle Faria-Kalkanis from Sturgis Public Library and Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ray, what have you got?
So, speaking of children, from the last book, my next book is actually for young adults. It's called Rethink the Internet: How to Make the Digital World a Lot Less Sucky by Tricia Prabhu. And it's basically a survival guide to the internet, and it focuses on online bullying. Tricia Prabhu was cyberbullied herself, and she actually invented Rethink, which is a patented technology that combats cyberbullying and online hate. So basically what it does is it detects offensive content in the language that kids are posting and or about to post, and then Rethink provides an in-the-moment nudge to rethink what you're saying before you post it. And then the teens or tweens that are about to post that content take a moment to pause and rethink and decide whether they actually want to say this. And research shows that when adolescents are alerted to rethink their decision, they change their minds 93% of the time.
Wow, that's amazing.
We all need that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's amazing. and the overall using Rethink, the overall willingness of an adolescent to post an offensive message reduced from 71% to 4%.
Wow.
So it's really effective technology.
So is it some kind of an app? I mean, how do you get Rethink? How do you get Rethink for your kids?
Yeah, I would direct you to go to the website. Google Rethink and Tricia Prabhu, she has a great website that explains everything. And the book is basically it uses stories to teach kids like the morals of different things that they can post. And so I really like the way she does it, because she uses, you know, anecdotes she has little characters, and so you're really learning about the effects and the consequences of negative, basically hate speech through entertaining stories. And then at the end of each chapter, she recaps the moral of the story, basically, and she poses a challenge to the reader, such as asking permission before you post a photo of someone, mm-hmm. or setting a goal to lower your daily screen time. Mm-hmm. So it's actionable things that you can take home and actually do.
Yeah.
And it really appeals to young people.
Yeah, I love that. All right, it's called Rethink.
Rethink the Internet.
All right. Gabrielle.
So following that, I have kind of a 3-for-1 here. I'll just kind of combine these because they're also sort of manuals that parents and kids can use as they're engaging with their devices. So the first one is called The Phone Book: Stay Safe, Be Smart, and Make the World Better with the Powerful Device in Your Hand by Jessica Speer. This is it's a sort of pocket size book, slightly larger than pocket size. It's really nicely illustrated in a format I think that's totally readable. It's geared toward teens. I would say preteens as well, for sure. And it includes puzzles, quizzes, secret codes. So there's some fun things to drive engagement with readers. Topics that it covers include why and how apps are designed to be addictive, the advertising model and money incentives behind apps, digital footprint, so like your reputation, what you're doing online, and the fact that that will follow you and stay with you.
Forever.
Yes. Detecting disinformation, social media, just general overview of how to engage with social media, FOMO, FOGI, and tech slang. So fear of missing out, and I don't know what FOGI is, but maybe a teen could call in and tell us. Stranger danger online, cyberbullying and drama, and how to use your phone to be a force for good. So it's not all negative. She includes many of the ways that phones are wonderful tools to help us, and how when we can outline what it is we want from these tools, then we won't fall into the traps of being sucked in and losing all of our time and attention on them. What I like about this is that she uses quotes and stories from other teens, so it makes it a little bit more relatable for the reader. And it's also, it was published in 2023, so it's not yet completely outdated.
Yeah.
I think
next
year, yeah, you get a good year out of this. I think when we're talking to teens, we can feel like, you know, this isn't cool. They don't want to deal with this. But I think she does a good job of making it readable, enjoyable, and also just a great place as a conversation starter for parents and kids and caregivers. So this one's The Phone Book by Jessica Speer. The next one is called The Social Media Playbook. And this one is by Krista Bone and Tracy Foster. And I really like this one because it's just, it's like basically a workbook. And you could imagine giving this to your child alongside their phone or at age 16 when they're allowed to use social media. And it makes it super easy. It breaks it down. Like the first section here is values. And it has, these are the 3 to 5 values that matter most to me. And then it has a box, a list with achievement, balance, commitment, community, connection, and it goes on and on. And so teens can, or, you know, social media users, young users, can start to define what their values are heading into this. And how could social media help me support and live these values is the question posed. Mm-hmm. And then there's another relevant question there. And it goes on, set your purpose. If you don't know where you are going, the social media world can be a race to nowhere.
I like that.
It's very short, brief. Sometimes with books with a ton of text, you can't really compete with a screen with a ton of images for young people's eyes. But this is something you could spend just moments a day on with together with the child in your life and have meaningful conversations. So this one's called The Social Media Playbook. I mentioned values and purpose, but it goes on and has time, safety, all kinds of different issues you need to consider. So that will be on the website. And then finally, in this category, creating a tech-healthy family, 10 must-have conversations to help you worry less and connect more with your kids, by Andrea Davis. This, again, is another workbook. This has a lot more text. It's more for the parent. So this is something you could kind of use as a reference. It gives technology plan ideas. There's different places to write in it. It's a bit of a workbook, but also just a bit of a guide. And it's really, like I said, geared to parents. So
yeah, because once you let that genie out, you can't put it back in.
It's good to be mindful ahead of time. And I think that's the benefit we have now. Whereas, you know, I think of some of the parents in my family who had kids, you know, even just 10 years ago, it was kind of the Wild West.
It was different, yeah.
It was just like, oh, everybody's doing this. This is fine. This is made for kids. But now we're able to be a little bit more critical and say, okay, how is this going to play out?
All right.
So the next one I'll talk about, and I didn't bring it in. We had just sold out of it.
Okay, it's a hot one.
Yeah. Well, I recommend it a lot. It's called Hidden Systems by Dan Knott. And it's for ages 12 and up. And it's a graphic novel, and it explains the systems that we depend on every day that are sort of in the background, but that we couldn't live without, basically. So it focuses on water, electricity, and the internet. And these are things that none of us in our everyday lives tend to understand. I really didn't know much about how these things actually worked before I read this book. And I highly recommend it to everyone. It's geared toward kids, but anyone could gain a lot from it. And it goes through how these systems were developed and how they're implemented in our world today, and also how they might be used in the future and how we can keep them going in the future. So it poses questions like, what was the first message sent over the internet? How much water does a single person use in a day? And how was the electric light invented? And so for every utility we use each day, there's a hidden history, a story of intrigue, drama, humor, and inequity. And this graphic novel provides a guided tour through the science of the past and reveals how the decisions people made while inventing and constructing early technology still affect the way people use it today.
Mm-hmm. And the name again is?
Hidden Systems.
All right. A listener says, excuse me, Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. It's about how technology changes our culture and society. That's another good suggestion. If you have a suggestion for us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Gabrielle, what's next?
So next I have The Ministry of Time by Kayleen Bradley. This is a time travel romance, spy thriller, workplace comedy, all in one.
Wow.
It's an exploration of the nature of power and love. So this book is set in the near future, where our unnamed narrator is a British civil servant who is tasked with a top secret project, which consists of gathering expats from across history to establish whether time travel is feasible for the human body, but also for the fabric of space-time. So she works as a bridge, which means she must live with and monitor the expat known as 1847, or Commander Graham Gore. So Commander Graham Gore is an explorer who died on a doomed 1845 expedition to the Arctic. So when he comes from his time into ours, he is disoriented by all of the social the ways that social norms have changed and also the technological advances. So readers see Gore amazed by things we take for granted, like washing machines, indoor plumbing. We watch as he flushes the toilet 15 times. he stares at airplanes in amazement, and he can't really comprehend the miracle of Spotify. So these things that we take for granted, that's where that technology piece comes in. It's a fun way of thinking about all of these technological advances that are in our daily lives and seeing them anew through the eyes of someone from the 19th century. Over the course of the year that this unnamed Bridge and Gore live together, what begins as an excruciatingly uncomfortable roommate dynamic evolves into something much deeper. By the time the true shape of the ministry's project comes to light, the Bridge has fallen haphazardly, fervently in love, with consequences she could never have imagined. She's forced to confront the choices that brought them together. The Bridge must finally reckon with whether what she does next can change the future. Ooh. So this is fun, witty, charming. The chemistry between these two crackles off the page. It's also smart and delves into some of the deeper territory with questions around morality and social constructs. So it's not just all fluff. Yeah. There's something there to sink your teeth into. The Washington Post review says you'd need a nuclear-powered flux capacitor to generate more charisma than Gore.
I love that.
So, and Kirkus confirms, they say Gore is a curly-haired, chain-smoking, devastatingly charming dreamboat. So this is a good summer read.
Yeah, that sounds great.
The Ministry of Time by Kayleen Bradley.
So many good books this morning. Yes. Ray, what's next?
So the next one is Unmasking AI, My Mission to Protect What is Human in a World of Machines by Joy Bolomwini. And this was really interesting because Joy did not set out to be an activist in her field. She ended up that way, but she really just wanted to code for the sake of coding. She's a very technologically gifted person. And for a long time, she believed technology could be apolitical and didn't want to bring social issues into her work. But eventually, she really realized the gravity of the inequities that were going on and entrenched in AI systems. And she decided to advocate for those who have been failed by AI, including herself. So the catalyst for this was facial recognition and the fact that AI tends to not see black faces and it recognizes white faces a lot easier. And she talks about the coded gaze, which is inspired by the terms male gaze and the white gaze. And the coded gaze describes the ways in which the priorities, preferences, and prejudices of those who have the power to shape technology can propagate harm, such as discrimination and erasure. And she goes through many examples of using AI in the court systems and how that it predicts, it can predict re-offenders totally inaccurately and often based on race alone. And she says, we can code prejudice into technology, even if it is not intentional. And so through personal anecdotes and rigorous research, she reveals how biased data and flawed algorithms can lead to discriminatory outcomes in areas such as facial recognition technology. And Bolomwini advocates for greater transparency, accountability, and diversity in AI development to mitigate these harms and ensure that AI benefits all members of society. So there's definitely hope in it, and it's not, as you say, the gloom and doom viewpoint on AI. There's definitely ways that we can improve it for the future.
And it's called Unmasking AI. All right, Gabrielle.
So I'm going to do one that piggybacks off of that because we're already talking about AI. This one, next one's called AI Needs You, How We Can Change AI's Future and Save Our Own. This is by Verity Harding, who was one of Time's 100 Most Influential People in AI. She is the director of the AI and Geopolitics Project at the Bennett Institute for Public Policy at the University of Cambridge and the founder of Formation Advisory, a consultant firm that advises on the future of technology and society. So just in keeping with what you were saying, this book talks about the choices that are made that shape the way the technology influences society. So you can make choices that are based on profit motives, or you can make choices that are based on helping people. And these are deliberate decisions that are made. So she uses, let me see here, she draws inspiration from different lessons in history, including different tech revolutions, including the space race, in vitro fertilization, and the internet, to empower each of us to join the conversation about AI and its possible futures. So like I said earlier, we've had a little bit of time to grapple with how things have played out with, you know, the internet revolution and what lessons can we take from that. Thinking in this book, she covers sort of like she doesn't get into in depth with the legal implications, but she does talk about, you know, legal considerations, moral, ethical considerations, and how to place humanity at the center of the discussion about AI. Because again, these are tools. They're very powerful tools. They're important tools, but it would be a mistake for all of us to just buy into the hype that these are magical, miracle, you know, creations that are going to revolutionize and save humanity. So I highly recommend we all take a little bit of time to consider what we want from our technology with AI Needs You by Verity Harding.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to suggest a book on technology, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show. We are talking about books on technology this morning with Gabrielle Faria Kalkanis, reference librarian at Sturgis Public Library, and Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to suggest something for our book list this morning, 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ray, what's next?
So next one makes me smile so much. It's called A Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers, and it's part of her Monk and Robot series. There's only two books out right now, and I'm hoping the third one comes out soon. It is a very sweet and heartwarming story of a robot and a monk and their adventures together. It's part of an emerging subgenre called solar punk, which is, it's described as hopeful and not totally negative science fiction that assumes humanity will solve some of its most pressing current problems and make a better world.
Solar punk. So, Dan, yes. You heard that. Solar punk. The sci-fi reader in there. Solar punk. He probably already knew it. Okay.
So in the story, long ago, robots left mankind to its own devices, and now they're back, and they want to ask the difficult question of what do people need? And this is a question that the monk really struggles to ask, and they're trying to discover their identity and their purpose in life. And it's a really difficult question to answer. I'm just going to read one of my colleague Caleb's review of the book. And he said, one of the best hope punk books, see, there's lots of different names for this genre out there, I have ever read. The plot is simple but effective. It is such a feel-good book with an ultimately positive outlook on our purpose and life. This book has made me cry every single time, and I will return to it again and again throughout my life. And I wish I had wrote down the quote. They talk about nature and the need to protect nature in the book in a way that I haven't really come across before. And let's see if I can remember how they put it. They talk about, how the wolves were removed from Yellowstone Park and it messed with the entire mm-hmm. climate. Sorry, this is getting ecosystem, into nature more than technology.
Okay.
But they reintroduced the wolves. And so when they took the wolves away, the biggest problem was the elk that were not afraid of the wolves anymore, so they just ate everything. And so they mentioned how fear for your life is so important in maintaining a healthy ecosystem. And I thought about that because it's like sometimes a struggle to convince people that it's important to try to save our environment. And sometimes the response is, well, I'm not going to live in fear. I'm not going to, mm-hmm. you know, but I think that fear is very important. So sorry that got away from technology.
I love that. But no, that was good. And it's called?
It's called a Psalm for the Wild Built.
Well, I actually think that technology and environment are so closely related, and they actually are in this next book, so it's a good segue. So I had read that the author name, the name of the book is The Future by Naomi Alderman, and I had read that she came up with the idea for the book after she learned about tech billionaires creating apocalypse bunkers, like real-life tech billionaires. The one she specifically mentioned was a property Mark Zuckerberg was developing on a private island in Hawaii. So that got her thinking, these people with so much power and so much influence prepping to save themselves in the event that things turn for the worse, and how a lot of this technology is not great for the environment and doing active damage. In the case of AI, I know it requires a lot of computing power and energy. So there are issues that are raised about the environment, not just the societal harms. Mm. So the premise of this book is that a handful of tech billionaires have gotten together to create an escape plan for a cataclysmic event like a climate disaster or plague or a societal breakdown so vast that the best option is escape. These tech moguls have predictive technology that tips them off to society's demise days before anyone else knows anything is happening. Then they initiate an elaborate protocol to whisk them away to undisclosed remote locations that are fully stocked and self-sustaining with every modern convenience. This story is written in parallel timelines, so it follows different characters who are acting at cross purposes. So we have some characters who are motivated by greed and self-interest, and some who are trying to rework the technology that has hastened the end of the world in an effort to save it. So what we end up with is a white-knuckle tour de force that keeps readers flying through the pages to find out what happens next. As you flip through, different sections are written in the format of message boards, so it has a tech feel right on the page. And what drew me to open this book, and after she said that, her inspiration for the book, she's mentioned how she ended it on a hopeful note. And I was like, okay, because a lot of these climate disaster, technology, mm-hmm. scary stuff, you don't even want to pick it up because it's too real almost.
Right.
So hopefully this hopeful ending is also real and something that we can think about as instead of just going on a doom spiral and doom scrolling.
Right.
So this is The Future by Naomi Alderman.
Right.
So the next one is The Age of AI and Our Human Future and it's three authors, Henry A. Kissinger, Eric Schmidt, and Daniel Huttenlocher. And it explores the implications of AI and the questions it raises, in part by examining the history of humans and their relationship to technology. And one of the quotes that I liked from it is, when we no longer explore and shape reality on our own, when we enlist AI as an adjunct to our perceptions and thoughts, how will we come to see ourselves and our place in the world? How will we reconcile AI with concepts like human autonomy and dignity? And I think that sort of brings to mind the identity question and the purpose question, because a lot of the thoughts that came up when I was reading these books is I realized how little humans are needed on the planet. And with AI, we don't even need ourselves. and so that's going to be a really hard thing to grapple with as we move forward with technology. But what was really interesting about this book, there's a New York Times article that Kevin Roos wrote in 2021, and it's called A Robot Wrote This Book Review. And so he writes the first few paragraphs of the review, and then he says, well, you know what, let me just let ChatGPT finish this review for me. So he explains how he put those paragraphs into ChatGPT and had it finish the article. And it's really funny because the ChatGPT took a few times before it could actually write the article, but then he realized how quickly it could learn, and it actually came up with something decent, but then he goes through and critiques it. And the way he ends the article is really funny, and also gives you hope for the future. But I highly recommend, if you read this book, to also hunt down that New York Times article.
And the book is?
The book is The Age of AI and Our Human Future.
Okay. Gabrielle.
Do you think I have time for two more?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to go with Going Zero by Anthony McCarten. I wanted to pick some kind of just thrilling, page-turning novel for people. This is edgy. It's a techno-thriller with twists and turns. It's a race against the clock, which is always fun. So I'm just going to read the cover flap. It says, 2 hours to vanish. 10 Americans have been carefully selected to beta test a groundbreaking piece of spyware, pioneered by tech wunderkind Cy Baxter in collaboration with the CIA. Fusion can track anyone on Earth, but does it work? One chance to escape. Each participant is given 2 hours to go zero, which means to go off the grid and disappear, and then 30 days to elude the highly sophisticated capture teams sent to find them. Any zero who beats Fusion will receive $3 million. If Cy's system prevails, he wins a $90 billion government contract to revolutionize surveillance forever. For one contestant, an unassuming Boston librarian named Caitlin Day, the stakes are far higher than money, and her reasons for entering the test are more personal than anyone can imagine. Caitlin needs to win as badly as Cy needs to realize his own ambitions. They have no choice but to finish the game, and when the timer hits zero, there will only be one winner. This brings up issues around advances in facial recognition technology, and privacy, and artificial intelligence and data location. That's the kind of stuff that can be scary, you know. But
it's okay in a novel, right?
It can be, yeah, really entertaining in a novel. And of course, I love that the main character is a Boston-based librarian.
Of course.
So that's Going Zero by Anthony McCarten.
Okay. Ray.
So the next one is called AnnieBot by Sierra Greer. And my colleague Lynn describes this book as a cross between 50 Shades of Grey and the movie Her. it is about a relationship between a female robot and her human owner, Doug. And it explores questions of intimacy, power, autonomy, and control. So AnnieBot was created to be the perfect girlfriend for her human owner, Doug, designed to satisfy all of his emotional and physical needs. She has his dinner ready for him every night. She wears the outfits he likes, all kinds of ways of pleasing him. Mm-hmm. She's not the best at keeping Doug's place spotless as he wants her to, but she tries very hard to please him. And Doug says that he loves how Annie's AI makes her seem more like a real woman. So Annie explores human traits such as curiosity, secrecy, and longing. She finds that becoming more human also means becoming less perfect. And so as her relationship with Doug grows more intricate and difficult, she starts to wonder, does Doug really desire what he says he wants? And in such an impossible paradox, what does Annie owe herself, and how does she find her identity and maintain her dignity? And my colleague Vicky says, wow, this was an absolutely fantastic story that deals so well with deep issues of relationships, AI, power, love, autonomy, abuse, lies, and their consequences. The author brilliantly gets into the head of her main character, Annie, an autodidactic robot whose life becomes much more complicated as she evolves and makes choices. This would be an awesome book club choice.
It sounds like a movie.
Yeah.
What's the title again?
It's called Annie Bot.
Annie Bot. Okay. Gabrielle.
So my next one is a children's picture book. It's by Beatrice Alamagna, and it's called On a Magical Do-Nothing Day. I'm just going to page through it.
I love do-nothing days.
Yes, they're magical, just like the title. It's beautifully illustrated. The first page here, we have moms on the computer doing work, and the little girl is on the couch on her device, and you can see that she's probably playing a game, maybe watching a video or something, and it looks kind of rainy outside. And then you flip the page, and I can see myself and that mom right there turning around from the computer and saying, put that device down, which is obviously contradictory. My kids always point that out. Well, yeah, you're on the computer. You know, my excuse is that I'm doing work and this is no fun. So anyway, she goes over and she takes the device from the child and she hides it. And it's kind of funny because it says here, she took the game out of my hands and hid it as usual. 2 seconds later, I found it as usual and went outside. So the child takes the device and they go outside. It's kind of rainy. She looks really upset to be forced outside. She wants to just be laying on the couch with her game. But she starts to walk through the woods and down the hill. And again, the illustrations are just beautiful. There's a lot here to take in with your child. At the bottom of the path, she finds some rocks in a pond. She starts skipping over the rocks because that's what children do. Mm-hmm. And out of her back pocket flies the device right into the water.
Whoops.
And she's devastated. She's really upset. But what unfolds after the fact is she starts to notice things. Here she's noticing the snails crawling through the forest floor, all the bright mushrooms, the wonder of nature, and she's using her imagination. Yeah. So it continues on in that fashion, and I think it's a wonderful way of opening up conversations with your kids who maybe can't help their...
What am I going to do outside?
Exactly. Yeah. And they can't help being attracted to their devices. So that's just a good way of opening up that conversation with little ones. That's On a Magical Do-Nothing Day by Beatrice Alamagna.
And we will have a list with all the books we talked about up on our website a little bit later today. We got to pull it together at capeandislands.org. Gabrielle Faria-Calcanis, reference librarian at Sturgis Public Library, and Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop and Sandwich. Thank you both.
Thank you
so much, Winnie.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.